After two controversial self-rule referendums, separatists in eastern Ukraine proclaimed the birth of two new sovereign republics. The pro-Russian organizers in Donetsk and the neighboring region of Luhansk said an overwhelming majority of those who cast their ballots over the weekend voted for independence. The U.S., EU, and the Ukrainian national government in Kiev say the referendum was illegitimate and a violation of international law. Moscow said it respected the outcome of the referendums and called for peaceful, practical implementation of the people's wishes in those regions of eastern Ukraine. However, Russia has avoided any suggestions of preparing to annex the regions the way it annexed Crimea following similar votes in March. This past February, protesters in Kiev ousted Ukraine President Viktor Yanukovych, and the country has been ruled by an interim government ever since, with elections for a new government scheduled for May 25th. The ongoing crisis in Ukraine has intensified tensions between Russia and the U.S. Augustana College Government and International Affairs Professor Joe Donnellinger joined the program in March following the Russian annexation of Crimea, and we've invited him back for his perspective on the latest in Ukraine. He's with us on the line from his office in Sioux Falls. And Professor Donnellinger, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carl.
Well, when we spoke in March, you didn't have a very optimistic view of how things were going to play out regarding the crisis in Ukraine. Anything surprised you about what's happened over the past couple of months in the region?
No, unfortunately not. I think in March we talked about, for example, the expansion of the protests into eastern Ukraine. I mentioned that the Russian objective is to make eastern Ukraine essentially ungovernable as far as the Kiev government is concerned. And I think we also mentioned, and we also talked about Odessa. And if you look back to last weekend, it certainly was the second bloodiest single event in recent Ukrainian history after the protests on Maidan Square in Kiev. And the story continues. By the way, I would also argue that the logic that underlies the annexation of Crimea is very much present in the current situation with regard to Donetsk and Luhansk and other oblasts of eastern and south and southern Ukraine.
And what is that logic? Is that
the logic behind Crimea was that it was turned over in an act of, if you wish, administrative arbitrariness by Nikita Khrushchev in 1954 to Ukraine to commemorate a treaty, then 300-year-old treaty between the Ukrainian Cossacks and the Tsars of Moscow. On April 17th, so just about a month ago, President Putin introduced, or rather reintroduced publicly, a concept called Novorossiya. And what he argues is that this area was conquered by Imperial Russia in the 18th century. It includes, for example, Donetsk, Luhansk, Odessa, and Nikolaev Oblasti, or regions. And Putin also says on April 17th, quote, "Only God knows why Russia surrendered the region to Ukraine in 1922. So is he looking at the eastern towards south central, towards southwestern regions of Ukraine in similar terms as he looked at the so-called arbitrary act of transfer of Crimea to Ukraine by Khrushchev? That's an interesting question.
So Putin essentially just looking to recover the lost territories and influence to restore elements of historical Russia?
If you look at his public statement, that certainly seems to be underpinning a partial dismemberment of Ukraine based on a transfer dated back to 1922 and going back even further to a Russian conquest in the 18th century.
Well, it sounds like if that's the situation, that there's not a whole lot that the U.S. and Western governments can really do, at least regarding sanctions and that sort of thing, that even if they have a strong economic detriment on Russia, if that's that almost seems like that's irrelevant to what Putin is trying to do.
Could very well be. Now, as far as sanctions are concerned, if you want them to work, they need to be coherent and coordinated. They're not at this point. You also have to remember that sanctions are only one tool in an arsenal of tools. Sanctions are never an end in themselves, nor do they constitute a strategy. They're necessary, perhaps, but not sufficient. Unilateral sanctions, particularly by one or two countries, are essentially useless in a world and a global market. Individual sanctions targeting individuals, while it might sound good, often are overrated in terms of their results. And sanctions tend to work only over the long haul, and if you take them seriously, they will boomerang back on you. In other words, you have to be ready to make sacrifices. And I do not see that readiness at the present time, on either by the United States or by a number of European countries.
What are some of the other tools in addition to sanctions?
Well, that's a good question. Some of the other tools may be credibility. Let's not underestimate that. Unfortunately, the American brand in Europe is heavily damaged on that basis, and the president has not exactly helped himself when it comes to drawing lines over in different parts of the world and over other issues. So we are being faced with a very complex situation right now at a time when our credibility is not exactly at its peak.
Do U.S. leaders, EU leaders, have much of an understanding of, say, Putin's motivations in regards to the Russian identity, the Russian history that you were just talking about?
Oh, you're raising a very important question, and I have my doubts about that. When you look at the ideas that may be underpinning this, besides perhaps the authoritarian inclinations of a leader in Russia, the ideas not only are geopolitical ideas, such as the reference to Novorossiya, but there's also a very, very interesting and not always internally consistent brew of ideas which are increasingly buttressing Putin's move. One of them is, for example, an idea of national Bolshevism, which may sound strange to you, but let us recall that Nazism stands for National Socialism, and there are similarities in the ideologies between the two. There's also an ideology of Neo-Eurasianism, a new form of Eurasian identity led by Russia that is juxtaposed to the Western world. If you allow me to elaborate, a Russian-American journalist by the name of Masha Gessen, who wrote the book The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, in the Washington Post some weeks ago, points to Vladimir Putin's December of last year's address to the Federation, the equivalent, if you wish, of our State of the Union address. Now, what does he emphasize in that address to the Russian Federation, to the assembled delegates and representatives? President Obama has mentioned that today there is no Cold War because, after, unlike the Soviet Union, Russia leads no bloc of nations, leads no global ideology. Well, Masha Gessen begs to differ. He says that what has happened over the last couple of years in Russia is that a new ideology has taken shape. It's pushed over the airwaves by state-controlled television and media. It is a new interpretation of the Russian national idea, and it's the driving force behind a newly aggressive international posture, and it is explicitly anti-Western. Let me quote from Putin's December address. Here's what he says. He says that Russia does not have superpower ambitions in the sense of a claim to global or regional hegemony, although I would disagree with some of that, particularly regional. But he says, we will strive to be leaders in a different way. In terms of Russia's relationship with the West, Russia will assert a new leadership. How? This is quoting Putin. This is absolutely objective and understandable for a state like Russia, with its great history and culture, with many centuries of experience, not of so-called tolerance, neutered and barren, but of the real organic life of different peoples existing together within the framework of a single state. And Putin continues, today many nations are revising their moral and ethical norms, eroding ethnic traditions and differences between peoples and cultures. He says, it's time to resist the scourge of tolerance and diversity creeping in from the West. We know that there are more and more people in the world who support our position on defending traditional values, he says. So what you have here is the articulation of essentially an anti-tolerance, anti-relativism, anti-Western ideology that accompanies the geopolitical aspects of Eurasianism. And this is very, very interesting. And interestingly enough, it is finding echoes, ironically, amongst a nascent European right.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking with Augustana College political science professor Joseph Dondelinger, discussing the situation in Ukraine and what that means for Russia and our relations, those relations with the U.S. Much has been made about Ukraine being divided on east-west lines. How pronounced is that? That's something that Russia seems to strongly stress. Is there a strong breakdown between east and western influences within Ukraine?
Well, if you look at a new CNN poll of 1,000 people called over the telephone, apparently that is not the case. On the other hand, one has to be very, very careful. Silent majorities are not necessarily agenda drivers. We saw this, for example, in the city of Sarajevo in Bosnia in 1991. We saw it in Croatia and in Serbia in 1991. Extremists can drive agendas unless they're stopped. Question is, how do you do that? And there is no good solutions to do that at the current time in Ukraine, as far as the West is concerned.
Is the West just going to have to back off on efforts to have more of an influence in Ukraine and give up any thoughts of having Ukraine associated with NATO?
Yes, absolutely. That thought not only is not supported by the Russians, but it's not even supported by many of the governments in the West who regard this as a provocation. I guess the most favorable outcome may be what you would call the Finlandization of Ukraine within the borders that it still retains. That is, Ukraine would have a government that, both in its domestic and in its foreign policies, may do nothing that would in any way be upsetting to Moscow. That's what the term Finlandization, in fact, means. Whether Ukraine can stay within the borders that it even currently enjoys is a rather large question. Moscow talks about the federalization of Ukraine, giving greater regional autonomy to eastern regions or south-central regions of Ukraine. But in many ways, that is a code word for, at best, a confederation of Ukraine, a loose confederation in which the ties in the east would become closer and closer to Russia itself, short, perhaps, of outright annexation, as was done in Crimea.
Would these breakaway republics that just had the referendums this weekend, would they be is that part of what they would like to see, you know, a federalization where they would have, more autonomy with a close relationship with Russia? Or do they just not want to be a part of Ukraine, at least with the government in Kiev?
Yes, but we may already have moved beyond that point. If you attribute any credibility to the so-called referenda that were held in Luhansk and Donetsk Oblasti.
Well, we've got the national elections on May 25th to establish a new government in Ukraine. Will the results of those elections have any impact on resolving the crisis?
Can those elections be held effectively in eastern Ukraine, I think, is a big question. If they cannot be held effectively and honestly, perhaps with some outside supervision, the results will not be credible, or at least they will be chosen to be seen as non-credible by Moscow in particular.
So it really makes a difference what happens in the eastern part of Ukraine.
Yes, it does.
The Donetsk and Luhansk, those republics will participate in this election?
Well, that's an interesting question. And under what conditions? In other words, what will the honesty of the election be? Will voters be hindered? Will voters be intimidated, either openly or they know better not to participate in that election? Can a Ukrainian government from Kiev actually organize those elections effectively in those two regions and maybe other regions as well? Those are interesting questions, and we don't know the answers to that.
In looking at U.S.-Russian relations, I think we discussed this a little bit last March when you were on the program. We're essentially in a new era here, that things have been reset?
Absolutely, and not reset in the way we suggested a few years ago. By the way, we're in other new eras as well. For instance, what's very interesting, the German National Democratic Party, which is a German right-wing extremist party, was recently quoted as saying that it can see a spiritual and national renaissance of Europe only on the foundation of a strong Russo-German friendship, unquote. And it now calls itself Germany's new peace party against NATO war politics. There's one of the things you need to do is open your mind as to the permutations and possibilities of where this is going to lead. And there are some very, very interesting permutations. For example, while Putin labels the Kiev government as fascists and repeatedly does so and insistently does so, ironically, rising right-wing parties in Europe, like the National Front in France or Vlaams Belang in Belgium or the Jobbik Party in Hungary, support Putin in his anti-Atlanticist or anti-Anglo-Saxon positions. So you have a really interesting mix. Meanwhile, the European left also supports Putin in part because it has never gotten used to the United States or Washington winning the Cold War, and still, to some extent, laments that the Soviet Union as a great power has disappeared to keep the Americans in check. There's just fascinating stuff going on in ways that, if you think in terms of either-or scenarios, you're going to miss them. By the way, when it comes to Putin's challenge to the West, please look, for example, at the connection to the anti-gay laws that are being pushed in Russia right now. Please look at the connection to the anti-profanity laws that are being pushed in Russia. You need to pay attention, for example, when a vice premier of Russia, in this case Dmitry Rogozin, tweets after the recent Eurovision win by a drag queen from Austria. Here's the tweet from the vice premier in Russia. Quote, "This showed supporters of the European integration, their European future, a bearded girl." This is a Russian vice premier tweeting in response to a Eurovision contest directed at, as a criticism, at the Ukrainians who want to look west.
Well, Professor Donlinger, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us in Dakota Midday and helping us understand that to look at this as more than just an either-or situation, that there's many, many different implications here.
And many dimensions, yes.
Right. Thank you so much. Joseph Donlinger is a professor of government and international affairs at Augustana College in Sioux Falls.